Blog Talk Radio.
We're back, and we have a surprise for all. We have a hard line. It is Tuesday. Everybody's happy. This is Backroom Politics. Here. Downtown. With me, as always, every Tuesday, which is from Pub Talk Radio, is our usual roundtable of political pundits, international experts, starting with, he is the former 8th Senator, great state of Washington, Emmy Award-winning broadcaster, and internal or external lobbyist here in Washington, Congressman Al Swift. Al, thank you, Mr. D. It is technical. We'll talk about that in a second. He is 35-year veteran of Washington politics, the former minority counsel of the House Rules Committee, former vice president of Government Affairs in D.C., and a member of the advisory committee of the University of Manhattan, Gerald Ford, Presidential Foundation. He is the Honorable Bob Line. Bob, welcome. It is, but it's a committee of the University. Okay, you know what? This is a good segue to our executive producer and the executive director of First Congress Society. The White House is on top of our number. He is very classy. Harry, no, man. Director of the Eurasian Center's China Program, Vice President of Global Business Development at the Eurasian Center. He's a member of the District of Columbia and New York Bar. He is Dr. Ralph Winney. Ralph, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Shitty and
Kyla.
That's awesome. So, here's the trick, kids.
Shitty and what?
What?
Shinny and Kwila.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Gong Xi Fa Cai. Happy New Year.
Here's the
much
problem.
Prosperity.
Here's the problem. I don't know what you're saying. I can't segue out of that. For all I know, you just
Hold on. You just
offered me 5 yen for a cow.
I'll segue out of it. Bob and I were just talking, and I was reading over your shoulder. You read those lines wrong. I didn't type them wrong.
No, currently a member of the advisory committee of the University of Cincinnati's College of Law.
And a trustee of the Gerald L. Ford Presidential.
All right. Make it a separate bullet from now on. Wow. So the big news here, obviously, at Backroom Politics is we have our biggest technical problem solved, it looks like. We have our hard line, dedicated line for Backroom Politics here at Shelley's Backroom. I have got to give props and thanks to Bob and Na, who are the proprietors of Shelley's Backroom. They have been very supportive from the beginning. They are the ones who helped us get the hard line installed here. They believe in the show. They believe in what we're doing, and they think it's a great idea. And to them, thank you, thank you, thank you. For the 8 or 10 that are listening out there, please, if you're in Washington, D.C., come by Shelley's Back Room, have a cigar, have a drink, enjoy yourself. It is still, as Bob puts it, what is it?
It's the best place in town.
That's right. It's the place to be here in Washington, D.C. Now then, in the past couple of weeks, you've noticed that we've had technical issues, and we've kind of gone into a slight hiatus until this hard line was installed, but there's been a lot of activity here inside Washington and internationally. The big, big ticket news item right now covering everybody's mind other than Egypt, which we'll get to later on in the program, The big ticket item right now is the 2012 presidential budget request has been sent to the Hill. All, what, 8 pounds of glorious budget reading. It is, to say the least, stirring up a lot of controversy. It is stirring up a lot of comments back and forth. People on the Democratic side aren't big fans. People on the Republican side aren't big fans. The one person who's caught in the middle of this is the president and the Office of Management and Budget. So we look at, and then today we had the president give his first press conference of the year, dedicate an hour-long press conference in the East Room, and just let it all out on the table. He's getting mixed reviews for that press conference, but let's start on the budget itself. There are so many things we can talk about the budget. One of the things that has been brought to my attention is somebody made a comment to me the other day and said it looks like the president is actually starting to take a more proactive approach in compromise in this budget. A lot of programs that he supported are taking hits. The one that was most notable was the Race to the Top program basically was almost zeroed out. And that was an Obama program for education. What's going on here? Al, you've seen what's been going on with the budget. You've been involved in several of these budget cycles in your years in Congress and then afterwards here in Washington, D.C. What makes this different, this year's budget so different, and why is this budget so critical to the president?
What makes it so different is that we've got to get serious this time. We cannot continue to run up deficits the way we have. I can remember when I was in college, I said, what is all this about the deficit? And I was told, don't worry about it. We owe all the money to ourselves. Well, now we owe all that money to the Chinese. This is not a good thing. We and a number of other industrialized nations have to get their budgets under control, and we are so far in debt that there is no easy way to do it. You're going to have to make cuts that will make Republicans and conservatives unhappy. You're going to have to make cuts that will make Democrats and liberals unhappy. You're going to have to make cuts in the military, which makes a lot of people unhappy, and you're going to have to raise taxes, which makes everybody unhappy. Hence, the president has stuck his toe in the pool. He's got it in there. He's got a few cuts that are already raising hell. And the Republicans are standing on the side throwing rocks at him. What neither has done is take on the serious issues, which are the entitlements, Social Security and Medicare and so forth and so on. The Republicans have been hooting with derision for the president having not taken them on, but they notably have not taken them on either. So it's a very different situation than usual because it's more serious and because whatever you do, if you do the right thing, you're going to make a lot of people mad.
Well, that's a good way to bring up anybody who would like to comment on your thoughts. For those of you who are out there, we invite you to call in. This is an active participation show. We just ask that you be civil. No name calling. No rhetoric. No dialogue that is adverse to the political betterment of our country. If you are interested in offering your comments or if you have any questions for our roundtable, please call in at area code 619-638-8477. Again, the call-in number for Backroom Politics is 619-638-8477. We'd love to have your call here on the air. Bob, from you've heard Al's comments. Take it from the GOP's viewpoint. How is this working out, and is this working into Speaker Boehner's line of fire? This should be right up his alley.
Well, I'm not so sure that the Republicans got their act together totally yet.
Really?
Not at all. Let's take a quick look at the budget numbers. About 40 to 41% of the budget is what we would call insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. About 13% is discretionary spending. Now, most of the cuts that the Republicans are making in the current budget, the current year's budget, the continuing resolution, which will come to the floor in a few weeks, is all in that, almost all in that discretionary area. All the money that the president is talking about is in the discretionary area, too. And the big insurance programs have not been touched by anybody.
Well, let me ask this question, because I know that there's, you know, hopefully there's a lot of people not inside the Beltway who have not been involved in a budget cycle before. The news outlets have been promoting the discretionary spending issue as being the big target issue. Al or Bob or Ralph or Perry, can you guys talk a little bit? Can somebody describe the in elevator speech terms, what is discretionary spending?
It's everything the government does except Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Defense.
And that's about it.
That's it.
So the $282 million for anti-drug efforts in Mexico, that would be discretionary spending.
Discretionary spending.
The money to run the Washington Monument, the money to keep the post office going, the money to...
Agricultural grants. You know, there's no money in the budget.
The post office.
It's discretionary that there isn't a group of citizens, part of the population, who feels very strongly about those programs. That's why they exist. So every time you cut one, you're going to get a large complaint. And when you, and the reason that no one has talked about the big insurance programs is because those touch everybody eventually. And the only way to solve that problem is for both parties to come to an agreement. There's something along the lines of what Mr. Bowles and Mr. Simpson and their commission, organized by the president, they made a report in December. And that is, it's good, a roadmap as to what has to be looked at as anything anybody has seen in a long time.
So when we talk about, discretionary spending, we're talking about services that normally every citizen in the United States takes for granted as just being there, whether it's the delivery of my post, whether it's the delivery of my mail, whether it's, you know, the police protection that... that they provide at the Jefferson Memorial or any of the national monuments,
exactly.
The Park Service. The national parks are discretionary spending.
It's educational.
Discretionary, the word discretionary is an accounting term.
Right.
And used by accountants, that's fine. But it seriously misdirects or misidentifies what we're talking about to the average layman.
Well, you know, and the funny thing about it is the average layman, I don't think, understands that out of the total budget, this budget cycle in 2012 is 40% of this year's budget proposal or fiscal year 2012's budget proposal, 40% of the total value is, in fact, discretionary spending, all these services that everybody takes into account. So that being said,
and nearly half of that is military spending.
No. Military is not discretionary.
No.
That's the
but
point.
But there are discretionary military programs.
Correct. There are discretionary military programs. Every department has discretionary spending in their budget request, is the way that we understand it. As such, you know, certain programs, whether it's the Joint Strike Fighter, the aerial tanker, and DOD, those are considered. Discretionary programs, I guess, as opposed to the funding of military personnel for national defense, which is a non-discretionary funding issue. Social Security, not a lot of discretionary funding there. That's all non-discretionary.
Medicaid is the same.
Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, absolutely. But, you know, looking at the budget proposal that the president put out there, if you look at the White House says that we would barely, or the White House proposal outlined by a senior administration official, which is according to the Washington Post, would barely put a dent in deficits that the congressional budget analysts could say could approach $12 trillion in 2021. Is this in fact the presidential budget as he has proposed? Is this in fact just a red herring? Is this just a dog and pony show?
No, it's a start to a process.
Okay.
And both sides don't want to be the first ones to touch the so-called third rail, all of those non-discretionary spending. So this was a little tap dance. He's come out, he's offered some cuts. They're going to argue about those cuts for a while. The Republicans will have to come up with something. We'll argue about that for a while. And then hopefully, I say hopefully because there's no guarantee, somebody, the president or John Boehner or Harry Reid or somebody is going to say, we better get into a room and get serious about this, fellas. And Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, and liberals get in a room and put those non-discretionary Social Security, these others, in the table. And then lock the door till they come up with a solution and then all come out together and vote it. And it's not that there won't be a backlash, but it will be against everybody, not just one party or the other.
Well, you know what? We're coming up on the first break here. We're quarter after the hour. We're going to take a quick 2-minute break. When we come back, I think one of the things, especially with the news focusing on the budget itself, what I'd like to do is, for those out there in internet radio land who are listening, it might not be a bad idea to take a couple of minutes and talk about the budget process and how that actually works. I don't think a lot of Americans, and even a lot of, you know, who we're hoping are listening, a lot of the college students that may be starting to come into American government may not truly understand what the process is. We hear words like discretionary spending. We hear words like conference. We hear all those words. Maybe it'd be a good idea to take a couple of minutes and talk about the budget process when we come back for the break. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom in downtown Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We are back live from Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C., 1331 F Street. It is still the premier cigar lounge here in the nation's capital. And for those joining us from the last segment, we're talking about the 2012 budget proposal put out by the White House yesterday. And President Obama gave his first press conference of the year today, an hour-long press conference where he took everything and all things and put it out on the table. But one of the things that we want to do right now for everybody out there in Radio Land that's listening to us, we want to take a couple of minutes, and I'm going to ask Bob, because I think there's a lot of people who think they understand, but really have never heard somebody who's familiar with it, as familiar as you are, Bob, with the budget process. They see this large document, you know, the 200 pages of the budget and the 8,000 pages of appendices go up to the Hill, and they deliver it on these big pallets, and they drop it, and everybody's, all these staffers are grabbing it. What is the budget process, Bob? How does this work?
Well, anybody who's listening, sit down and do something to keep yourself awake.
He's livening it up a little bit for you, Bob.
Here's what happens. In the fall, first of all, the fiscal year of 2012 began on October 1st of 2011. What happens is in the fall, all the departments and agencies, all the independent agencies, all the departments, all of them, each one of them is responsible for, in effect, proposing their own budget. All those budgets go to the Office of OMB, the Office of Budget Management, which is a White House budget operation. Jack Law, who's a very talented and gifted guy, is now in charge of it. That office takes a look at the entire fiscal structure of the government. What are their projections of the revenues for the incoming year? What are the agencies asking for? How much of an increase? Which ones need money for new programs? Which ones are cutting programs? We don't need to raise as much money in that department. And they put together a proposal of the budget. The president and his cabinet then take a look at it, decide what they're going to do. The president makes the final decisions, and that is the budget that the president sent to the Congress yesterday.
Now, in between that, each department has to create their own budget request to the president.
That's correct.
And they stream out their line items, what they want in the program. OMB then says, yes, that's going to go in, or no, that does not go in. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then when it gets to Capitol Hill, as it did yesterday, it is both, the budget is sent to both the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee. And those two committees then, in effect, each write their own version of a budget resolution. The budget resolution will follow very closely the budget presented by the president. But each house will have a few tweaks here and there, add something here, drop something there under normal circumstances. And then the two houses will each pass their own budget resolution. It goes to conference, and the House and Senate conferees from the two budget committees decide what is the final budget. They will adopt a budget resolution, and that is the final budget.
Now, talk to me. We've heard over the past 24 hours, is this going to clear conference? What is the conference specifically?
Well, the conference is a meeting between high-level members of the budget committee of the Senate, senior members, Republicans and Democrats, and the senior members, Republicans and Democrats in the House, what they call a conference committee made up of members of both parties. They sit down in a room. They took a look at the budget resolutions each body has passed. They go through it basically section by section, department by department, agency by agency, and they negotiate a deal that is the final deal on that agency or department, and they just go all the way down the list. They get to a final package with a final number. They vote on it. They adopt it, and they send it to the it's signed by the Speaker and the President pro tem of the Senate, and it goes to the White House.
Okay. Now, that keeping that in mind, one of the big areas, and it is Nari has just joined us here in the studio, and Nari, thank you very much for having our hard line installed. She is the proprietor of Backroom Politics. Oh, she doesn't like to be
this
on the air.
This is why we love her.
She's very shy, media shy. Anyway, 1331 F Street, Shelley's back room. Come on down, have a cigar, have a drink. The big ticket item that's got everybody's attention right now is the cuts in defense spending. You're talking about $78 billion in cuts to DOD. as proposed by Secretary Gates. That is a huge, huge third rail. There's a lot of people in this town, particularly with a lot of the integration community, that's starting to go, wait a minute, how are you going to maintain a truly ready force with $78 billion in cuts? So my question is that going to stand, or is that going to be tore up in conference and in committees?
Well, most of those cuts, as I understand them, are to some, you know, they're moving some items around, but fundamentally they're cuts of specific weapons programs.
Right.
I believe there's some marine, amphibious tank or something.
Correct. Correct.
And basically, I think, again, that's on the cutting chopping block.
Correct.
The reasoning by the Secretary of Defense is that they do not see, the Secretary's office does not see the likelihood that we will have too many troops wading ashore in various places in the world and need
we're not going to see Omaha Beach anytime
soon. We're not going to see Omaha Beach.
Right.
And that's... may or may not be true, but certainly the Secretary believes it to be true.
Because you can't send a message to your adversaries that you're cutting defense. It will embolden air.
That's right.
Well, that brings up a very valid point. Is, you know, I mean, the media is literally swarming about $78 billion in cuts to DOD. What does this send? I mean, and we had a long discussion with you about China and the Chinese defense mechanism.
Right.
Are the Chinese sitting there thumping their chest going, that's right, who's a superpower now?
Well, they're looking at the whole budget. I mean, they've been very concerned about our borrowing and spending, and they've, because of their interest in our economy.
They sell. We're their biggest customer, practically.
Absolutely. And at the same time, they want to make sure that they're dealing with a very strong, a very capable country that they can look up to and respect. And part of that means you have to keep a very strong military presence, at the same time be able to balance your budget, keep the books in order.
Because I guess, let's take it. This, I don't know how much of our debt the Chinese own. Do you, Ralph? I think it's got to be what?
It's number two, I believe, behind Japan.
Just
they've refused to buy any more debt.
Yeah.
Right.
You know,
and right.
And we've got a lot of debt. We've
right.
got a trillion and one or a trillion and two deficit for this current fiscal year
right.
that's just begun.
Right. And they're talking now, the White House has now come out and said there could be as much as $12 trillion
yeah.
by 2021, which is an astronomical number.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a number that no normal...
It's a number that nobody sitting around this table or nobody in the White House or on Capitol yeah. Hill can get their arms
right.
around. In the sense of how big it is and how damaging it is to the overall economic growth of the country.
Sorry, you had a comment?
I just wanted to jump in on the defense cuts. One of the things that people are forgetting a little bit in the coverage of this is that a lot of that $70 billion are not just, you know, a reduction in our foreign troops or something like that. They're targeted cuts that were recommended by Secretary Gates. For instance, like you said with the amphibious vehicles, another example would be shortly after President Obama took office. He said, look, there's currently a program in the works to develop a new Marine One, the helicopter the president flies around, and then a whole new fleet. And he said, you know, after flying it a couple times, it's perfectly fine. We don't need billions and billions of dollars in new helicopters. So that in no way hurts our, you know, foreign defense or anything like that. It's a target cut, but it amounts to a lot of money.
It does.
But there are a lot of Republicans, especially coming out of the Tea Party movement, that are asking for deep cuts in the military. And if those go through, that puts that us in a very precarious situation.
Well, we should also remind ourselves also that within the next year to year and a half, this and the next fiscal year, we're going to be bringing troops home from both Afghanistan and from Iraq.
Right.
And you bring troops home, you save an awful lot of money.
Correct. And that will be an immediate cost savings as well. But it's still, that's not factored into the $78 billion that Secretary Gates has put forward as cuts in the industrial military complex right now,
right.
which is huge. Which is something. I mean, let's be honest. It's been a the DOD has largely been looked at as untouchable. DOD has largely been looked at as something that it you just don't take funding away from DOD. That's what keeps America strong. Al, I got a question for you: is does the president's allowing $78 billion in defense cut, does that maybe come across as maybe Obama being a little weak in defense, or is this something that he's just saying, look, we've got to compromise on this. The Republicans can't have it all, and we're not going to have it all.
If you cut a dime out of the defense budget, somebody is going to say that it's a demonstration of weakness. It has been a sacrosanct item in the budget forever because nobody wants to be accused of lacking in patriotism. But there is, I have never seen a bureaucracy as big as the Defense Department in which you can't squeeze some money out of it. So I think I definitely would support keeping the Defense Department on the table as things where you should find cuts. With all of these cuts, you need to figure out what's fat and what's bone, what's muscle, and that's certainly true of the military. So it's not that you should run in and start chopping away at our defense capability, but it is time to move in and, maybe remove some military bands and get rid of Cadillacs for generals and things like that.
But that's widely held as an unpopular view in the general populace. Defense is the one program that I think everybody would agree on needs to stay not only fully funded, but even in some instances, an increase.
That's because it's been demagogued by one side so badly, and the other side hasn't had the guts to stand up and defend their position.
Let me suggest something about these particular cuts. The gentleman who is the Secretary of Defense has been active in intelligence matters and military matters under a series of administrations of both parties.
Agreed.
Right.
He is not a person who has an axe to grind either to cut it or not cut it. And he's taking a good hard look at what has to be done and what will still be a more than adequate defense posture. And I think that it's fair to say that most fair-minded people who don't have an axe to grind can take a look at what Mr. Gates is doing and say, well, I may not exactly agree with everything he's doing, but he certainly is an honorable and straight guy. He served several administrations of both parties. He knows the Defense Department backwards and forwards. And if he says that X number of dollars is a reasonable number of cutting and it will not damage our security, I think that's probably a pretty good situation.
If I were in Congress today,
right,
I would take what the Secretary has proposed and put that in the drawer. That's enough. Then I would start getting fairly conservative about how much farther I went, because I think that would have to be looked at very, very carefully. So it's not a case of it. People who want to cut some military budget are always seen as taking an axe to our national security, and that's just nonsense.
Right.
Well, we can encourage your allies to help pay more of the costs of the military.
Well, now you're getting into another third rail. You know, the funny thing that I've noticed in my years in dealing with Washington is defense has always been a third rail. But in that third rail, there are different circuits that attach themselves to that third rail. One of them is, do we get the allies to pay? Does the British, do the French, the Italians, does NATO, the members of NATO, do they put up a little bit more money or do they put up a little bit more bodies? Basically, do they cowboy up and say, it's your turn to pick up a little
bit
of that?
Or even Japan. We're paying for their
for their national defense force. That's correct. Well, we're going to take another break. We're at the bottom of the hour. This last segment was underwritten by RSDC. RSDC is a government services provider here in Washington, D.C., providing IT management, providing program management support to government and private clients alike. For your government program management needs, contact RSDC at rsdcgroup.com, rsdcgroup.com. We'd like to thank RSDC for their support of Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. I got to tell you something. It is so nice not having to worry about, is it going to drop? Are we sounding crappy? This is fantastic. This is how a radio show should be run. Just so I throw that out there. Anyway, for those of you who are joining us after the bottom of the hour, we've been talking about the presidential budget request. That has been the topic du jour of most of Washington these past couple of days. The one thing is, the noticeable things that we saw is, and I go back to a comment that I made earlier, is it looks like that President Obama is making an attempt to give and take as needed, that there is some concessions, there is some compromise in this budget, arguably. You look at, you know, at President's State of the Union address, his big talk was education, making America great again. The question is, or the issue he put forward is, education has to be at the center point of what is making us, whether it's education in math, science, technology, etc. That is one of his premier focal points. Yet, we saw his program, the Race to the Top program, literally almost get zeroed out in his presidential budget request. I go to you, Bob. Does this mean that the president is actually putting forward an olive branch saying, look, I'm giving up some of this, but, oh, wait a minute, we have to make an announcement. Oh, Bob's here. Bob, the proprietor of Shelley's Back Room, is here. Bob, first of all, we have just been talking about how great Shelley's is, and we want to thank you for the hard line. Bob, thanks a lot for putting this in. Thanks a lot for supporting us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's
love
great.
That. Thank you, Bob.
That's great, Bob. Thank you. It's working out perfectly. It's working out perfectly.
Even Al's booming voice.
Even Al's booming voice, exactly.
Boom, boom, boom.
So going back to my question, is this in fact the president's attempt to compromise?
I think that the president is in fact looking for things that he and the Republicans can work together on. I think it's fair to say that his budget, I think, is not aggressive. I think that the let me step back one minute for a moment. There are reasons to believe, I think, that we can come to some agreements on certain things. Example, going back to the President's Commission on the Budget, Tom Coburn, who is as conservative as any senator I know from Oklahoma, very strong and a very principled man, signed on to a proposal, proposals that the commission made that raised taxes.
Right.
Dick Durbin, the deputy whip, the deputy leader in the United States Senator on the Democratic side of the aisle, signed on to a proposal that within them included Social Security amendments that would, in effect, one of them was to raise the age of eligibility. Now those two points, a man who's against tax raises and a man who is against any change in Social Security as matters of deep belief, both of them are willing to sign on to an effort that would cause both of them to have to vote in areas that they were opposed to in principle, but they knew they were going to have to do something in order to solve our budget problem.
Al, in looking at the presidential budget as it stands right now, are you seeing the influence of the presidential or the budget commission in this cycle? Or
no, not really, and I find it disappointing. But I keep coming back to the fact that this is the beginning of the dance, and who knows what strategy the White House has worked out, or for that matter, the Republicans have worked out. Neither one want to step on into those third rail issues by themselves. So what we've got to do is, before we start shooting holes in the bottom of the boat, we need to get everybody on the boat so that they have an equal interest in plugging the holes, not drowning. And I think the president started out, he did have some cuts in programs he likes. He didn't cut as much as the Republicans wanted in other areas. It's not a bold thing at all yet, but you can go in all those directions from where he started if you want to. Now I want to see what the Republicans' initial. He's made the first move in the chess game. I want to see what the Republicans respond to.
Bob, what is the next move in this?
Well, I think the president maybe took the first step toward the next move last week when he had, it was last Thursday or Friday, he had lunch with the Speaker, the Majority Leader, and the Majority Whip of the House. And they had apparently a good discussion. It was probably on areas where they can generally agree on as opposed to what they can't. But even on those areas, I think the fact that he is reaching out to the Republican leadership and saying, we got to find some solutions, at least in areas we can agree upon.
Well,
generally, I think that's important. And I also would say one more thing. Remind themselves of what Al said earlier. The way we're going to solve this is not with the president making a bold presentation and the Republicans dump it all over it, or vice versa. We're going to have to get the leadership of both parties and in both houses and the administration in a room together. They're going to have to lock themselves in and come up with a deal. That's what's going to happen.
Ralph, but I think the obstacle is going to be the Republican members connected with the Tea Party movement, because they feel they've been sent to Congress to make deep cuts in the budget, and they're not going to just be willing to compromise without deep cuts in the budget, including military and also some of the social programs.
You're absolutely right. I must give Boehner nightmares. But what you can see is, if they work it right, you can pull in most of the Democrats and Republicans who are not Tea Party people, you got a majority. Hard to do, but it's
be very, very difficult.
Well, you know,
if, as they are going to do, if the Republican leadership, which it's going to do, with respect to the continuing resolution, this is the budget you are in right now, not the next budget we're talking about. But the Tea Partiers have insisted upon a $100 billion cut proposal, which is available and is going to be voted on next week. It'll pass the House,
right,
most likely.
The continuing resolution.
The continuing resolution.
Okay.
It'll go to the Senate. The Senate will not agree to it. There will be some discussions. There will be debates, and there will be a negotiated agreement between the two houses, because you cannot fail to have a resolution adopted.
Well, this brings up an interesting point, though. I mean, we're in a situation right now, Al, where we've got a situation for the first time in recent memory where we have not been able to pass a fiscal year budget, i.e. the 2011 fiscal year budget, we are literally looking down the barrel of having an entire fiscal year governed by a continuing resolution. Does that put the Democrats in jeopardy as far as being a party of compromise? Are they going to take a hit for the fact that they're not going to be able to compromise on a budget?
I think that is something that the public generally doesn't understand very well. I don't think it's a very heavy political issue for either party to use. Stopping the government, closing down the government, which is the alternative, is something the public understands, and it's never it's left a lot of political bodies behind, and it's been tried in the past.
But Boehner is very uncomfortable about that scenario because he lived through it under Newt Gingrich.
That's right. And here's the point on this: once this continuing resolution debate gets settled, the Tea Party people have had their vote. They've had their vote. They voted for what they wanted to do. Now they're going to vote for. Now they're going to have to work out a deal that will solve their problem as well as advance the process of the continuing resolution so we can adopt one. Now, the point is, you may not get all you want, but Mr. Boehner is trying to make sure that they get their vote on the floor of the House. And he's going to be able to say to them, I got your vote, you've made your statement, now we're going to have to negotiate a little bit down from that because the Democrats won't accept it, and we can't let the government stop paying their bill.
Boehner's right about that, but it does, the vicious part of my mind suggests that maybe the best thing you could do to the Tea Partiers to get them to come to reality is shut the government down and blame them, the Democrats could blame them, maybe can't, and let them see what happens in terms of public wrath that gets visited on the Congress, not on the
president. First of all, Ralph, then Bob.
What Obama would like to have happen is to have a radical budget cut passed in the House and then have the DNC be able to send out advertisements to voters in the swing district. Do you realize that your member voted to cut school lunches or voted to cut library, emergency medical personnel, school teachers, so forth and so on.
Right.
So that plays into the Democrats.
And remember, the Republican leadership in the House, for the most part, was there when Mr. Gingrich, over the objections of Majority Leader in the Senate, Dole, in effect closed down the government. And Gingrich thought that he would be able to out-talk Mr. Clinton, with respect to why we cut it down. But the fact of the matter is, once you close the government down, the president's got a bully pulpit, and he'll win that debate
every time. Reagan shut the government down, and he won it.
He won it.
I mean, in public opinion. The Congress shut it down, and Clinton won it. And if he shut it down now, Obama will win. But I must say, given the wonderful reaction to my suggestion of shutting the government down in order to teach Tea Party Eliza leads me to believe that it's a very good idea.
Right. Well, I will tell you.
What
right.
are your responsible thoughts?
I want to bring up because the central catalyst is we've seen a lot of the majority in the House talking about the budget. We had a gentleman from Wisconsin, chairman of the budget committee in from Wisconsin, Congressman. Help me out here.
Ryan.
Congressman Ryan. Congressman Ryan came and addressed yesterday the presidential budget, but the one noticeable thing about it was that there wasn't really a proposal put out there by the Republicans. The Republicans are saying, this is not good, this is not good. There wasn't really anything of substance to say to offset what was in the president's budget. Is that going to be an issue for Speaker Boehner in the next coming weeks?
It will be if it continues. But, again, we're at the beginning of the process. And, and the Republicans, as we have mentioned, have got problems of their own. They're trying to put some things together, and I don't think that what you see now is what you're going to be seeing down the line a little bit. But it's going to take a while.
We have to remind ourselves that while the president – has a whole lot of people to put his budget together.
Right.
The House and Senate, or as we talk now, they're still trying to figure out a budget, not for beginning in October 1, but for tomorrow.
Right.
And they're trying to get a continuing resolution passed so that they can keep funding the budget.
Right.
All the departments and agencies and the Defense Department. But right now.
Let's throw this issue
that
out.
That money stops at midnight on the 3rd of March.
Ralph,
throw this out. What about cutting government pensions for members of Congress? They're trying to do that on the state level. They're trying to hurt the cut union pensions.
Well, I'm sure there are a whole lot of people in the country who would say that would be a good idea.
Well, President Obama already made the suggestion of cutting back staffing. I mean, actually having furloughs and layoffs in the federal government for the first time in recent memory. Perry.
And a lot of these things have been directed towards members of Congress. I don't know if you all saw the article that came out this morning about the so-called pajama club of the members who sleep in their offices, that they're now looking into whether or not that is a taxable perk, so, as are the reserve Because when this first started, it was you know, 3 or 4 members, but there's up to 60, maybe 80 members
that are actually sleeping
in their office. And what they're looking at is that a perk?
Well, there's
tax based on the fact that they are saving anywhere from $1,200 to $2,000 a month by doing this.
That's true. And we're gonna close out the top of the hour on the budget discussion. Our next hour, we're gonna talk about what's been going on internationally. Huge events have taken place over the past 2 weeks internationally. We want to talk about that. But in the last 5 minutes we have here, number one, I heard a comment on talk shows today saying that Speaker Boehner's actually playing this out like an adult as opposed to many members of Congress. He's actually taken a very proactive, a very positive stance and how to address some of these issues. Al, as a Democrat, former member of Congress, would you agree with that, or?
Yes, I think John Boehner is an adult.
No, I didn't mean that sarcastic.
He's obviously an adult, but I think he behaves as an adult in the sense that you used. He has, however, got a whole nursery filled with little brats and. It's not enough for him to be an adult. It's enough. He has to get some other people to grow up too, in order to be effective.
Bob, would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not so sure that I would say we have a bunch of little brats. What we have, most of the folks.
That's not civil.
I understand.
I can point that out.
Most of the people who came in as freshmen under the Tea Party umbrella are people who are not politicians who came out of state legislators or city halls or whatnot. They're business people, they're professional people. They got involved in politics because they just didn't like what they were seeing happening. They need to learn how the system works. And they're smart people and they're bright people for the most part. They wouldn't have got elected if they weren't, because you've got to be able to get up and talk and answer questions. You've got to be popular. So I think that given a little time and given an opportunity to make the votes they want to on their big budget cuts, as they're going to be able to do this week or next, I think they're going to be able to learn, and I think Mr. Boehner is a good person to help them understand how the system works and what is possible as opposed to what you wish you could do. And then they're going to have to be able to explain to their people back home, I couldn't get everything we wanted, but look how much we got. We got so much more.
Well, okay.
I don't think they'll fall into that trap.
Well, in the last couple of minutes here, I want to go around. Oh, now you see, now we've got compromise going on between Al and Bob. In the last 2 minutes of the segment, two questions round the table: yes or no, or just one word answers. Who's going to look like the rock star coming out of this budget cycle? Is it the president or is it Speaker Boehner? Ralph.
So far, it's Obama.
Al.
Well, so far it's Obama, and in the end, it better be both of them, because that's the only way you will have it.
Bob?
I feel the same way. There has to be a solution that both agree to.
And Perry?
What I was going to say was, I don't think either one of them will. I think that's a good thing.
Really? Okay. We're going to take a two-minute break here. It's almost the top of the hour. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room here in Washington, D.C. After we come back for the break, we're going to talk about the international events, namely what happened in Egypt, Iran, Yemen. Pretty much the entire Middle East is in turmoil. We'll talk about that here shortly. Stay with us. Here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, here in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. With me, as always, is the Honorable Al Swift, former member of Congress, Bob Hines, former staffer on Capitol Hill, former vice president of NBC for Government Affairs, Washington Insider, and our international pundit, Dr. Ralph Winnie, also our executive producer and executive director of the First Congress Society, Perry Blasteen, and I'm your host, J.T. Russell. For those of you who are staying with us for our second hour, we appreciate it. Please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477 if you want to participate in the discussion. Big, big news coming out of the Middle East over the past couple of weeks since we've been on hiatus. There is, for lack of a better term, turmoil thriving throughout the Middle East. The big news story, obviously, is the civil revolution, the relatively unviolent revolution of relatively being the key word, or arguably being the key word, of what happened in Egypt over the past 10 to 12 days. President Hosni Mubarak, who has been the, whether you want to call him president, whether you want to call him de facto dictator, Hosni Mubarak was departed his position of leadership as president of Egypt. He is now in seclusion at his resort home in the western part of the country. And they were, we also know that the Egyptian military has since taken over the government and has made a promise to maintain civil order as well as provide a solid transition to democracy for the Egyptian people. But there's breaking news coming out of New York right now regarding Egypt. It's a little disturbing, in fact. You know, we saw the pictures coming out of Egypt that were focused on, we saw what happened to Anderson Cooper. Anderson Cooper was, for lack of a better term, assaulted in the streets of Cairo trying to cover the uprising. But the latest news we've heard coming out of New York is 60 Minutes correspondent Laura Logan was in Cairo last week when Hosni Mubarak announced he was stepping down. In a statement issued by CBS, and I quote, "On Friday, February 11th, the day Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak stepped down, CBS correspondent Laura Logan was covering the jubilation in Tahrir Square for a 60 Minutes story when she and her team and their security were surrounded by a group involved in the uprising. It appears that Laura Logan may have been sexually assaulted in that detention, which calls into question a lot of what happened to media coverage and the correspondents that were there in Tahrir Square." That is something at 60 Minutes. Our heart goes out to Laura Logan and her team. That is obviously not a pleasant situation. Our thoughts are with her. I hope that the people who perpetrated that are brought to justice. But that's got to bring the question: is Egypt in fact being governed, or is it chaos over there? Absolutely.
Who do they think committed the rape?
So the statement, the government.
The statement out of CBS.
The statement that came out was just that her and her security team were separated, and she was surrounded by a group of individuals, and what CBS is describing it as a sustained beating and sexual assault. But they've said there will be no other information coming out about this, that she's currently in the hospital.
We don't know who did it.
We do know that she was, I don't know if rescued is the right word, but was surrounded by a group of about 20 women and Egyptian soldiers who protected her, ended what was going on, and got her back to her hotel safely.
But the problem is there have been a lot of thugs and criminals that have used this opportunity to take advantage of people. You've got the legitimate needs of the Egyptian protesters that have finally their whole movement now is kind of coming to fruition. You've got President Mubarak stepping down, and the peace treaty with Israel is still going to be honored. They're not moving towards an Islamic state as in Iran. In fact, the people are very much pro-Western, pro-U.S., but they want transparency and accountability, not only in their government, but they also want economic reforms to keep the country from going into bankruptcy.
Well, let me ask this question, and I posed it to Al as a former member of Congress. You were in Congress during the tenure of Hosni Mubarak. Largely, Hosni Mubarak was seen as an ally to the American government. In fact, you probably voted on several items of financial, military, economic support.
No doubt.
To the Egyptian government. Does the recent revelations of, what do we got?
Iranian lawmakers out for blood.
Wow,
opposition leaders.
Yeah, that's a whole nother.
Right.
We'll get into that in another second, because right now, for those of you who are listening, we are here in the smoking, crusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. And basically right now we're seeing reports out of Tehran where the revolts are not only becoming violent, but it looks like that The Ahmadinejad government is going to provide a huge crackdown on the uprising, something we did not see in Cairo. But going back to the Egyptian situation,
yes.
When we look at Egypt, with that vote, with that support, I mean, did we know back then what we know now, and had we known what we know today, would we have supported the Mubarak government in Cairo as much as we did, Al?
Well, if our governments, going all the way back to pre-Bill Clinton, had crystal balls, we might have played this a little differently.
Right.
But the fact is, we are a world power. We had any number of other responsibilities that we had to do, and we made agreements with some people who are not ideal Democrats, small
yeah. D. Right.
And we did it for very pragmatic, practical reasons. Had we had a crystal ball, had the current president had a crystal ball, he could have started shifting a little sooner and we would be in better position with the revolutionaries than we are now. But that's asking for almost superhuman insight into the future, I think.
Now, Bob, you were here in Washington during the transition after the unfortunate assassination of Anwar Sadat, who was truly an international statesman in the Middle East. Knowing what you know about the Sadat government versus the Mubarak government, was there a dichotomy there? Was there a transition from one viewpoint to the other, or did we view it as just a simple transition? Somebody who was a Sadat supporter.
We should remind ourselves that Mubarak was the vice president
under Anwar Sadat.
Under Sadat. I mean, I don't think you could say there's any fundamental difference in their policies. I think Al's right. We have to remember something. A British foreign minister once said, in the days when Britain destroyed the world, England has no permanent friends or no permanent enemies. It has permanent interests. And any country in the world that is a major power, India, China, the United States, you know, they all have interests that continue whether one party or another is in power in the government or one individual or not, because those interests are key. And I know that Ralph has a good idea about
Ralph.
What I'm talking about.
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's important to mention that when Mubarak took over, he was sort of an enigma. People didn't know much about him. And the economy that he inherited from Nasser was a total mess. The exchange rate was pegged along eight or nine different rates. And he took over and he tried to modernize the country. But at the same time, he enacted an anti-terrorism statute that exists to this day, which has been very unpopular among the Egyptian people. It's very similar to our Patriot Act. And that was one of the major reasons for
it. It was Sadat or...
Emergency. Looking at what happened in Cairo and looking at the uprising that happened in Tahrir Square, does that bring into question the stability of the Middle East? I mean, is what happened in Cairo arguably a good thing for the Egyptian people? Is that a good thing for the United States as we see it, or no?
I think it's a good thing for the Egyptian people, but they have to make sure the revolution doesn't destroy itself, like what happened with the French Revolution, where you had a lot of unemployed people with new ideas.
Robespierre.
But they ended up killing each other off.
Right. Bob?
We have to remind ourselves that after the Shah of Iran fell, they had a revolution in Iran, and it didn't start out with the mullahs running the place.
Right.
They were the best organized group in the country, and they and their revolutionary guards, in effect, took over the country, took over the unorganized, much as the Egyptian so far has been, the unorganized enthusiasm of the public. And they took, while the public was being happy about it, they took over the country.
And provided control and stability.
And what do we know about this? Is it a Muslim group that had been outlawed?
The Muslim Brotherhood.
And they seem to be the best organized.
Well, what do you
know, in Egypt.
Perry?
They are organized, and they are, as you said, an outlaw political party, but they were still operating. They have come out, though, and said they are not going to stand in the election that, in theory, is coming up in Egypt, that they're not interested in that, and in the interest of transparency and democracy, they are not going to get involved.
And I think less than 5% of the Egyptians support them anyway.
Right.
So it would make no sense.
However, a lot of foreign nations have made a big deal out of
it. But it does seem to me you have got a whole region of the country, of the world, a region that's very key for oil and a bunch of other reasons, that is becoming increasingly unstable. In a whole variety of ways, you know, country by country by country, they're in varying degrees of instability.
Well, we have countries like Yemen that are having similar civil unrest.
Well, there are demonstrations in Bahrain.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There are. I mean, we're seeing gatherings in Saudi Arabia that are coming out against the kingdom there.
And even in Jordan, which has been, one of the more stable governments along the way. In short, I don't think there's anybody in the State Department that's sleeping very well today.
Arguably. I can see that point. Now this brings up, going back to the question of the instability in Egypt, the one thing that was noticed in the civil uprising in Cairo was there wasn't a de facto leader of the initiative. There was no one single individual that you could see transitioning from Mubarak to this one individual. Americans kind of glommed on to the Google executive in Cairo, who was on 60 Minutes this past Sunday, very well spoken, but has no aspirations for political office in Egypt. But he was the one feeding a lot of the social media, creating the Facebook page. But the question then becomes is, as they transition from Mubarak to military and military back to civilian democracy, we don't have a de facto leader. Are they operating in a vacuum, per se? Ralph?
So far, they're operating in a vacuum. Hopefully, someone will emerge that can lead, that can be a true leader and be able to help enact the democratic forms that the Egyptian people are looking for.
Bob?
One can only hope that the military will continue as they are doing, in effect, protecting the integrity of the revolution thus far and not letting any disreputable people, we'll call them, get in a position of authority or power or have a chance. And as long as the military wants to make sure that that's the case, I think that there'll be natural leadership arise from that will be acceptable and strong leadership of the revolution.
Al.
The Egyptian army has an opportunity to pull a George Washington.
Really?
George Washington was the first democratically elected president of any country except for one ancient Greek who voluntarily gave up power. He was the first person in history who had power who said, I'm walking away from it. Now, it's not very often that the military takes over and the military then sets up elections and turns it over to a democratically elected government. If the Egyptian government, the Egyptian military does that, they should go down in history for a first.
They ought to get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Exactly.
It's quite unusual for them to support the people's demands, but they... Once they decided they weren't going to fire on the protesters, that's when things started to
change
for the better.
Will they now give it up? That's the
problem. The one thing that I've noticed, and the one thing that hasn't been truly brought up a lot, is the fact that it is a non-volunteer army in Egypt. Every male citizen has to serve in the Egyptian military after the age of 18. It is a very civil organization. When I say civil, it is based on the general public's involvement. That was part of the reason what we hear today, why the Egyptian military did not interject itself and resort to violence in that, because they are part of the general electorate.
And it occurs to me that these association that exists between our military and Egyptian military, which is very close, and a lot of personal relationships at high levels in both armies, may be an important factor in the strength on the part of the Egyptian military.
So far, they have been a restraining force, both on anything Mubarak might have wanted to do, but didn't do, and certainly they have been very helpful when the police started to rough up the demonstrators. It was the military that stopped it.
Right. Very true. Something to consider. Egypt used to have a very large Jewish community that was kicked out of the country by Nasser shortly after he came to power. Will this new government that emerges in Egypt allow these people to come back to their own country and be able to reclaim their property that was nationalized and confiscated? The other issue is with the Coptic Christians. For years, they have been treated as second-class citizens. Will they now be given full equality within the new government?
As well as with the Baha'i.
And the Baha'i.
Well,
correct.
You know, it is a good point. But, you know, one of the things that we have to consider, and even the administration, I believe, has to consider, is the point that, you know, we've got to take baby steps. I think that, the Jewish question, the Baha'i question, the Coptic Christian question is something that is going to be down the road. I think that in order for this to be successful, and I'm not being the moderator anymore, in order for this to be successful, the Egyptian military truly does have to take a George Washington stance. I absolutely agree with you, Al. That is a great, great analogy. They have to be the ones now, whether the head of the Egyptian military becomes that de facto leader as a civilian head of state, or they find somebody inside the current government, inside the current government is basically the military, but inside the civil ranks that can come up and continue on this transition, this peaceful transition to civilian power again, that is going to be critical. And unfortunately, every country in the region is going to be looking at Egypt and how successful they are.
Yes.
And that has got to be keeping Secretary Clinton and everybody in Foggy Bottom very, very much on edge.
Yeah.
Of course.
Here's an interesting thought that just crossed my mind. The military people, by their very nature, like order. It's necessary for their function, and they function on order. Democracy is unorderly at its very best.
And let's not forget there was high unemployment in Egypt, which was a contributing factor in this whole revolution. If you look at what's happened with China, they have blocked their citizens' access to what's been going on in Egypt.
Right.
Because they're concerned that something could happen within their own country if the economic demands of their people are not met.
But anyways, we're coming up on 20 past the hour. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we talked about Egypt. We want to talk about how Egypt is going to affect the rest of what's happening in the Middle East and how that's going to affect U.S. policy going down the road. There could be tremendous, tremendous impacts on how we view foreign policy. Economic impacts could be huge. There's a lot of stuff going on here, kids. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
And we're back live from Shelley's back room here in downtown Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. For the last 30 minutes, if you'd like to call in, if you have any questions about any of the topics we talked about, please feel free to call in. The number here is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. We encourage everybody to come and join our discussion here at Jelly's back room. We were talking earlier about the Egyptian issue and the issue that popped up with the civil unrest in Egypt, thus causing the departure of President Hosni Mubarak. The Egyptian military has since taken over government. They have guaranteed that they will uphold all treaties, which I'm sure is making the folks in Tel Aviv very, very comfortable. They have also said that they will ensure a civil and smooth transition of power back to a civil democratic state in Egypt once transition is formalized. But what we're seeing today and the news coming out of Tehran is that there is extreme civil unrest going on in Iran today. We've also been hearing rumors, or we've been hearing news reports coming out of the Middle East, of countries, some of our closest allies in the Middle East, including Jordan and the government of King Hussein. We've also heard there were demonstrations in Yemen. We've seen it in Tunisia. We've seen it in someplace as innocuous as Bahrain. Bahrain is probably one of the most stable governments in the Middle East. They're one of the most wealthy, and they're having civil protests in that region.
And Ralph? Just to let the viewers know, the Bahrainian ambassador to the U.S. is a woman, and she's a Jewish woman born and raised in Bahrain.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that is interesting. Wow, we'd like to have her on the show one time, if you know her. We'd love to talk to her.
You talk about viewers, you mean they can see us?
Well, if they walk by the smoke-encrusted nerve center, if you walk by F Street, you can knock on the window here in Shelley's back room and show yourselves to us.
I've waved to a few people.
I'm sure you have. I'm sure you have. But let's talk a little
None
bit.
None of them have taken you up on.
No. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Tehran. This is obviously something that's got some huge ramifications on foreign policy inside the Middle East, namely how we're dealing with Ahmadinejad and the government in Tehran. The reports that we're getting right now is that civil unrest has begun. Civil unrest is being met with strong, strong government opposition to the point of violence breaking out right now in the streets of Tehran. Out of all of the countries in the Middle East right now, the one that has probably got our attention most now that Egypt seems to have subsided and come into a status of transition is Iran. You know, as insiders, you guys have been around from the days of the Shah back to the days of the Muslim influence inside the government of Iran, and now to a state where there's now civil unrest that's calling for more democratic rule versus an Islamic totalitarian government. How volatile is Iran to what we're trying to do in the Middle East right now? Ralph?
Let me say one thing. So Ralph can gather his thoughts. But I said this before. I said it's amazing to me that 10 days ago, the Iranian government was cheering on the rebels in the square in Cairo. Today, when their own people are doing the same thing, they're not going to go to the head.
Max, a better hypocrisy. I mean, the lawmakers in Iran are wanting opposition leaders executed. I mean, the Iranian situation is going to be the most volatile because there are so many people now that are seeing through the crap that the mullahs have been perpetuating on their country for so many years. The problem is they're not getting any outside support.
Yes,
well,
used in international circles, I'm sure.
Yes, but, you know, we can be uncivil towards the Iranian government, which has oppressed and murdered millions, hundreds of thousands of their own people in the name of radical Islam. So
So, right.
Absolutely
no
stability for Iran.
No stability for Iran.
And the U.S. government has got to get tough with Iran and tell them there are going to be dire consequences if you go out and kill these people that are lawfully protesting. That has got to be a very strong message that is sent.
Al?
What?
You kind of cringed at that for a second.
Not because there's anything wrong with what he said. But if you go back to how we began the program and our budget, boy, would it be good if we had a few billion dollars to spread around in the Mideast right now.
To fund the opposition.
To fund the opposition.
And around.
And I don't think we're in a position to do that.
Yeah.
So whatever we can do, and I totally agree with your getting tough with it, but it's going to have to be diplomatically, and it's going to have to be with other nations in the world, because I don't think we're going to be able to run
into
it.
In the past, we've urged opposition movements to fight, but then we never provide the support. Look at what happened with the Bay of Pigs, and look at what happened in Iraq.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
You can arguably go back to Charlie Wilson's war in Afghanistan, where we successfully pushed back the Russian military front, pushed them back into Russia, and then we arguably just bailed. Right. Now the question comes up with that thought is, did we learn our lesson from that, or are we teetering on repeating history? Bob?
Well, I certainly hope that even if it increases the deficit, I think we should be doing anything we can in a very surreptitious way to support the people in Iran who want to stand up for that government.
So we've got two wars going.
Yep.
And you're suggesting a path that could lead to a third.
No, I'm suggesting a path that will support democratic individuals and groups and he can speak out for them and support them in any way that we can.
You've got to break the back of the mullahs. They control the whole scene in Iran. Everything has to go through the religious prism of Islam, and that's destroying the country. You've got a lot of bright young people that are willing to revolt, that are very angry about their situation. But the key will be to break the back of the mullahs and to provide support for the opposition.
And they have to do it themselves.
Absolutely. We can't interfere.
No. We shouldn't.
Well, now the question comes back is, how does the American government truly, truly promote or support without directly violating international treaty? How does the U.S. government support these efforts in the Middle East right now?
Well,
traditionally, with money, which we don't have.
Obama's going on the offensive and he's pointing out the hypocrisy of the regime, which is important to get international credibility behind the opposition movement. But there's going to have to be more. I mean, Al's right. We're going to need to pour money in there to help fund the opposition. And I don't know if we have the will or the backbone to do it.
I wonder whether this is the kind of thing where Obama will be able to develop a broad international effort so that our allies who often stand by and watch us solve the problem will join. Although a lot of those allies are as broke as we are.
Well, you know, we've got a global economic crisis, but we've got areas of the world, namely the Middle East, that are going to be looking for financial support. Look, Egypt took a huge economic hit in the days of the revolution. That is going to have to be, that's going to have to be subset by either international investment through organizations that we have here, like USAID, USTDA, or other global organizations. This would be a good time for the United Nations to truly show its true colors in how they can help deal with these different international efforts. Kevin, as a Republican, that is hugely, hugely unpopular supporting the UN. But Bob, you'd have to agree, as a Republican, this is the time when the UN could really cowboy up and make a show of itself and show its value to the international community.
The question is, can you make it happen? I don't know.
Can we get China, Russia, and all the major powers on board?
That's right.
Because the situation is going to crumble there. It's only a matter of time. Here's where we're hurt by the sanctions. We don't have our intelligence people over there to help the opposition there on the ground. Right. We have no intelligence gathering operations like the Chinese or the Russians have to help protect Durham.
So here's the question before we go to break. Is can the U.S. finally come around to supporting the UN and making them the true international proponent of civil democracy in the world community as we know it? Or is that a pipe dream?
I don't think we can, because most of the world doesn't agree with that.
Al?
Most of the world doesn't want to be a democracy yet.
Al?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Ralph?
Factor in the economic consideration. Everyone wants to have access to the oil. If there's a way to ensure foreign participation in oil revenue, they may be willing to help support the opposition.
You said the magic word. This whole region is a supplier of oil.
Yes.
We have not included that very much in this.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back. I mean, the dependence on foreign oil, I mean, that's been a political hotbed for the past 24 months. We'll talk about that after the break. That's a good segue. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
Nation's capital, and it is a lively crowd here at Shelley's back room tonight. It's a full house here at Shelley's. We are having a good time here, and for the first time, we have not dropped the line. We are getting full coverage here at Backroom Politics, so we're all happy about that. For those of you who are staying with us, we were talking about the issues going on in the Middle East, and Al brought up an interesting point before the break. The question of, I mean, make no mistake about it, this is a very oil-rich, oil-dependent economy in all the Middle Eastern countries, particularly in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. There's a lot of oil money flowing through there. And this calls into question is the instability in the Middle East and the dependence on foreign oil. Is the dependence on foreign oil, is that something we need to be concerned about, Bob, right now?
Yeah, we always have to be concerned about it because we have contracts on shore and we have relationships on the front. We're having new governments coming in. We're going to have different political views coming up. I'm sure there's going to be some. I don't think anybody is going to say we're going to shut the oil off, but the reality is we don't know. We don't know exactly who is going to be in charge a couple of years from today in any number of countries in the Middle East.
Well, you know,
the reality is it's an uncertain situation, and oil is a very necessary commodity in a whole lot of economies around the world, and your problems to develop. It would be a very serious thing, not only to us, but maybe many other places.
Well, you know, this brings up a point. You know, we talk a lot about the dependence on foreign oil. A lot of people don't understand. Our biggest importer of oil to the United States is Canada.
Right.
Canada provides us with more oil than any other country on the planet. Yet, we talk about the reliance on OPEC oil. The Canadians have said that their flow of oil is not slowing down. Now, unfortunately,
same for Mexico.
Mexico's our number two.
Yes.
At one time, it used to be Venezuela, but we had Hugo Chavez come in there and crush that. But what we have now is a situation where a majority of our oil coming into this country are coming from allied nations, not from OPEC. Why is it that everybody seems to have OPEC as the hotbed and the reliance on foreign oil is always focused on the Middle East? Ralph, I ask that.
Well, you've got to look at what Chavez is trying to do, creating alliances with Iran, Syria, North Korea, and the use of oil as a weapon in the combating democracy and free markets. Got to watch out for Chavez's role, especially in the way of being able to influence new leaders.
I think they're running into conventional wisdom, which is often right and often wrong.
Right.
I just think that the conventional wisdom says that the Mideast is flooded with all sorts of oil.
But why does every time there's instability in the Middle East do we look at that as, you know, we're going to have gas lines in the 70s again? I mean, going back to the conventional wisdom, right or wrong, it would be who of the administration and the government to say, hey, that's not really the case, kids.
You have to, it's like retraining the mindset to talk, look at alternative sources of energy.
The point you make is just superb. Maybe
we need to completely rethink
our oil in relation to our foreign policy.
Bob?
I would just remind us of this. You know, in business, it's the last 10-15% of revenue, which is your profit. Now, with oil, so let's say 80% of oil is coming from good friends, 20% is coming from uncertain sources. It's going to drive prices up. And that, you know, that is always a problem.
But yet we have a mindset in this country that says that every time we see pictures out of Cairo, out of Tehran, out of Dahar, they all look at it and go, oh my God, I'm going to be paying $8 a gallon for that. When in fact, that's not necessarily the case in reality.
It isn't reality, but it is the kind of scare tactics that happen.
Who drives that? Is it OPEC, Ralph?
OPEC has a very strong role. They control a lot of people in the U.N. in terms of getting votes. The mindset is oil is what makes the country, the world run.
Right. There's no question. We are an oil-dependent nation. No question.
It's going to take years to retrain the mindset of the American people that they should focus on alternative energy.
Al, you had a thought.
And you waited so long to call on me that I've forgotten.
That's our congressman. There's the L Swift we know and love.
You got to call the vote at the right time.
I got to do that. But, you know, it begs the question now is, why hasn't there been anybody in the administration, including an oil-savvy administration as we saw in the George Bush administration, why has nobody in the previous administration or the current administration made an attempt to try and even make a dent in that common thinking of our oil comes from the Middle East? That's it.
Well, the conventional wisdom in the Bush administration was he came from an oil background. All of his top contributors were oil people. So he was not going to look at other sources of energy or other programs because he couldn't risk losing political contributions.
We see folks like T.Boone Pickens, who has made an incredible, incredible stance on our dependency on foreign, arguably Middle East oil, and he's seen the front end of that. We've seen oil companies arguably profit by that conventional wisdom. Is the thought that maybe the oil companies don't want that conventional wisdom to go away? Bob?
I have no idea. But I will tell you this. I mean, it is useful for any customer to have as many sources as possible that are reliable, because that's the way you help keep the price down. So we need to have stability in the Middle East, because that helps to keep the price down. Once the Middle East gets upset, it scares a lot of people.
Out.
And one should not underestimate even Pickens' ability to think of himself first. We see the ads he's running. The question that comes to mind is, how does Stephen Pickens benefit?
Right. Well, good question. All right, we're coming in the last 10 minutes. Ralph, you got a comment real quick?
I was going to say, if you look at China, they are seriously looking at alternative sources of energy. One of the big reasons is they're tired of having to rely on other countries to provide them oil and natural gas. So they want to see the best way to develop solar and other alternate sources of energy within their own country.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to close out this segment. When we come back in 2 minutes, we're going to finish up, have our usual roundtable discussion. It is something that I know everybody out there that listens to us on a regular basis just sits on the edge of their seat. It's Tell Me a Story. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Kelly's Backroom. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. It is the last segment of our show this evening. It is the segment we like to call Tell Me a Story. So we go around the table and we have everybody give us a little piece of intel, a little piece of political insider that hasn't been brought out in the active media yet, and something for you guys to think about so you can say, hey, I heard that on Backroom Politics. We're going to go around the table. We're going to start with Ralph. Ralph, tell me a story.
Well, the Obama administration has been scrambling now that John Huntsman has said he's going to step down as ambassador to China and possibly run for the Republican nomination in 2012. It appears that Gary Locke may leave Commerce and go to China to be the next U.S. ambassador to China. Gary Locke speaks Chinese.
Wow. That could be a scoop.
Absolutely.
So you heard it here first on Backroom Politics. We're hearing a story that Gary Locke could be the next ambassador in China. That would be a good scoop. Al, tell me a story.
I'm going to pass, and if there's time, I'll come back.
Okay. Bob, tell me a story.
The Speaker of the House is doing something that I think is very wise as he deals with his new Tea Party energized majority. Many of these folks are not professional politicians. They come from all walks of life, many of them business people. And they are not the kind of people who are always negotiating, compromising, etc. And their political agenda has always been very strongly stated. Mr. Boehner, when the budget committee came out with a relatively strong, if not $100 billion, prorated over the year, the Tea Party people objected. The speaker said, okay, let's go back and let's do more. And they have done so, and now the House will vote on a very large budget cut as part of this year's continuing resolution.
Wow.
Now, the point is that Mr. Boehner is trying to help his team, his new members, how the system works. He's trying to help them understand that you're going to, we're negotiating with you, and you're going to have to negotiate with us, and we're all going to have to negotiate with the Senate. We can't expect the Democrats to have the same view we do. And we're going to have to compromise to get as much as what we can get. But we're going to go in there and fight. We're going to support you guys. You guys got to support us, the leaders, and we'll get what we can. It's a deal-making business. That's what politics is. Compromise. Agreement to agree, and then go forward. And he's trying to help them learn that as quickly as they can, because he does not want to see the Republican majority in the House fail.
Wow. Perry, tell me a story.
So one of the subjects that we did not discuss at all today is something that was huge in D.C. in the last week, which was CPAC. Nominees and members of Congress, various political activists, and I'm going to make what I'm sure is a very surprising prediction.
What's that?
Which is that despite winning the straw poll for the second year in a row, Ron Paul will not be the Republican nominee.
Wow, grasping the obvious, Perry, that's why we hired you, buddy. Al, tell me a story. Go ahead, Bob.
30 seconds. The best and most realistic statement made CPAC was by Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, who spoke truth and said, this is what we have to do to be successful. It's going to be cut. We're going to have to change our ways. We're going to have to cut. Some of the things we're going to have to cut are things we all like. But that's what we have to do to be a governing party.
Is Mitch Daniels, in fact, preparing himself for a run in the future?
I think Mitch Daniels probably realizes he may never be president, but he's saying what has to be said, and he's saying it in a very articulate and very intelligent way.
Al?
He is certainly doing this because of all the
I would give you that. I would give you that. Okay. In the last few minutes, I want to just throw a shout out to our underwriter for this show, RSDC. RSDC, Federal Program Management Support Agency. They do a lot of work here in the federal government. They've been very generous with their time and the equipment to help bring backroom politics to you live from Shelley's back room. Go to rsdccorp.com for more information. On behalf of Ralph Winnie, Al Swift, Bob Hines, our executive producer and executive director of the First Congress Society, Terry Blasting, I'm your host, J.T. Russell. Thanks for joining us. Check in with us next week at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, where we'll have another show live without interruption from Shelley's Back Room. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.